Welcome to the second episode of Future Tongues and the second episode of the series on Keats Twitch. In this episode, I talk to Heike Wiese, a professor of linguistics at Humboldt University of Berlin. Professor Wiese is among the leading researchers in the world in Keats Twitch, in both the public and academic sphere, and is the author of Keats Twitch, Ein neuer Dialekt entsteht. In English, Keats Twitch, A New Dialect Arising. She has worked at Potsdam University for many years, and at Brandeis University and Yale University, each for 1 year as a visiting researcher. Professor Wiese is also a member of Germany's Council for Migration, a nationwide association of scientists who address questions of migration. Today's episode examines identity and society for Keatsdeutsch speakers. Professor Wiese and I talk about the linguistic landscape of Germany and how the conception of a standard language can exist in a nation of notable ethnic and linguistic diversity. We also talk about multilingualism in German cities and the public perception of Keatsdeutsch. Finally, as an experienced linguistics public intellectual, Professor Wiese shares her thoughts on how people and institutions can be more sensitive to linguistic diversity. Thank you so much for being on the podcast, Heike.
Well, a pleasure.
Before we get into Keatsdeutsch, I first want to actually talk about Germany and Germany's so-called monolingual habitus, the sort of fancy linguistics term for the notion of a national language. And I want to start with this because I originally had a misconception, which was that Germany wasn't really a nation of immigration, but it is. At least, you know, in recent history, more so than the United States, statistically speaking, Germany is, in fact, situated in the middle of Europe. It's the crossroads of much immigration and emigration within Europe and beyond. So I wonder, how then does this monolingual habitus arise? How is the dominance of standard German upheld in a nation where cultures and, more importantly, languages converge?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually a good question. It's kind of absurd, isn't it? I mean, you, in fact, have the same kind of monolingual habitus in the US, where it's just as absurd, because Germany has always been multilingual, and it will always be multilingual, as every normal country. The reason why both the US and Germany have this strange a monolingual habitus, we do as if we are a monolingual country, even reality doesn't really support that. The reason is in the history of the European nation state building. So in the 18th, 19th century, we have this building of European nation states, the idea that you're a country that is supported by a people that forms a nation. And in Germany, the question, of course, what characterizes this nation? I mean, it was a pretty diverse bunch, like always. One idea was one central factor that was identified, that this is what defines Germanness or the German nation in those days, was the language. Didn't have such a strong link with reality even then, because, of course, we had this large diversity, different languages, different dialects of a language. But that was the idea. So from that time in Germany, as similar in other European countries, came this idea, what defines a nation and a proper country is speaking the same language, be it English in the US, where you've inherited this from Europe, sort of, because being a settler colony of Europe, and in Europe itself, of course.
So it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of concept of Germanness. When I was reading through some of your work, you mentioned that Germanness seems to exist beyond just the standard language. In fact, some of the some of the dialects which have existed longer in Germany also have this concept of Germanist attached to it. So I want to just ask, like, what is this concept of Germanist, and how does this manifest in maybe the public discourse, and how do Germans perceive this Germanist?
I couldn't speak for how Germans perceive Germans for everyone, but let's say historically there's a strong tendency to relate this to some kind of jus sanguinis, you know, blood relation.
Yeah.
You have this often. If you have an ethnic group, people believe this ethnicity is defined by something like a shared regional origin plus some kind of blood relation. So if you're, say, Turkish German, you're that because your ancestors came from Turkey, this kind of idea. And that also holds for Germany as a whole, that you have this kind of idea of a shared ancestry, say. Isn't true, of course, but so if people of this constructed shared ancestry then are associated with a certain dialect, then this dialect is considered German. Take the old regional dialects, Swabian, Hessian, Bavarian, but also Lower German, which one could discuss whether it's a separate language or a dialect, but that's never very clear. But also, for instance, Texas German, which is spoken by people who, I mean, who might have had ancestors that came from Germany, maybe not even everyone, but don't really have a strong cultural tie to Germany, I would say. But it's considered a German dialect because it's spoken by these people who are constructed as relatives.
Then I want to think about the sort of more recent multilingual developments in Germany. So in Berlin, for example, there's an extremely diverse population. There's a big Turkish population, Russian population. There's immigrants from Arabic-speaking countries. And so especially in cities, it seems, multilingual is a really big part of German cities and is actually one of the reasons for which Kiezdeutsch was actually able to develop. That's from at least what I've read. So I'm just wondering, how do multilingual cities like Berlin, how, for example, are multilingual speakers able to maintain their heritage languages, and how does multilingualism perpetuate over time?
That's a good question. It's often pretty difficult for families to do this, to keep up their heritage language. So let's say your grandparents immigrated to Germany from Turkey. Then how do you manage to still speak Turkish with your kids and they actually answer in Turkish? So all of us who come from multilingual families know the problem. The parents are always complaining. So I address Mehmet in Turkish and he will answer in German. So if you're in Germany. So this is a very common thing. And especially in countries which are strong, with such a strong monolingual habitus, because in Germany, German is so strong that they realize this, they see this society and they think, so why should I learn Turkish in addition? Or in my family, my husband's British, why should my daughters put the effort into learn English in addition? Yeah. So, but a lot of families, including mine or my neighbors, we have English and German, my neighbor has Turkish and German in the family. Parents put a lot of effort into this and try to pass on this kind of cultural heritage they have in this richness that they can pass on to their children. But it takes a lot of effort in such a setting of monolingual habitus. And it also, it helps, of course, if you have a larger community. And there are quite a few people, families, say in Berlin, who speak Turkish and German at home. So that helps to support the heritage language.
Right, that's an important distinction, I think, because to make between the United States and Germany, for example, because I'm a victim of this. My parents speak Chinese, and so they speak to me in Chinese and I have to respond in English. And so certainly there's a similarity.
You're one
there.
Of those kids, huh?
Yes. I like to think that I didn't practice my language enough when I was younger to be really proficient in it.
But the great thing is that your parents did that. So
right.
you understand, don't know, Mandarin or Cantonese?
Yeah, both.
Oh, both. Wow. That's really cool. So you understand both Mandarin and Cantonese, and you can always brush up on it.
Right.
So that's a really great basis. And also it's a connection, isn't it? So we lived in the States for a year when our oldest daughter was still very small. And I was sometimes asked by people, why don't you speak English to your daughter? Why would I?
Right. And,
my main reason was also when she was a baby, I wouldn't even know these baby words in English, you know, these words that are emotionally very close. So right. when I say to my baby, mein kleines Schnuckerputzchen, what would I say in English?
Right.
Even if I knew, it wouldn't be so close to my heart. So there's an emotional aspect too in passing on this language.
Right. So like this process like of learning heritage languages, it seems then, you mentioned it's part of a community. And so like, for example, in cities like Berlin, very diverse ethnically and linguistically, there's an environment for this multilingualism to perpetuate over time. Over here in the States, for example, I live in the suburbs. There are houses by houses lined up in swirly streets. So there's really no contact. Yeah. So
a very clear picture.
Right. You can imagine it.
Stereotype and not very real.
Yeah. No, it's true. Then I'm just wondering, how does multilingualism appear in the urban areas, in the public space specifically?
Yeah, you see it everywhere, depending on the language. Yeah, so you see English a lot, of course, because it's kind of an international language, pop culture and so on. But I have a whole collection of multilingual, I wouldn't call it graffiti, it's more like scribbling, you know? When, imagine yourself at 13 years old and you're scribbling on some wall, so-and-so loves so-and-so, or I miss you so much, my darling, blah. And that's what kids do here in different languages, or mixing different languages, using what all they have. So it's part of the linguistic landscape. It's also part of public life. You have some multilingual signs. You might be able to use, say, Turkish or Kurdish or Arabic or Russian at a bakery or at a grocery, depending on what kind of repertoire the shop assistants have.
So I think then the question here is, how does this multilingualism in the community produce a multi-ethnic like Keats Deutsch? What is perhaps the process by which this happens? Maybe it's too technical to cover here, but maybe you could give a general overview.
And that's also something that goes beyond Germany, that you see in other countries too, and not just in Europe. So the, let's say, urban dialects have always been multilingual. The traditional Berlin dialect has emerged in a multilingual setting as well. But what's special about these new urban contact dialects like Kiezdeutsch and similar is that you have a very highly diverse setting with lots of different people born in the country, locally born. So let's say grandparents from Turkey, but I am born in Germany. But I find myself growing up in an environment where this is true for most of my friends, that their grandparents or parents immigrated from elsewhere. We are Berliners. We are the new generation. We are not from some Turkish village. We are not from some Arabic country. We are not from Russia. We are from here. But we all know this kind of immigration experience from our elders, parents, grandparents. So these This often supports then some kind of multi-ethnic youth culture, where it's cool and urban to be like that. So when I think of my kids in kindergarten here in Berlin-Kreuzberg in a city district, there were hardly any kids who spoke only German. So for my kids, it was totally normal they're being picked up by daddy and speak with him a language that others don't understand, English. Somebody else gets picked up by their granny and speaks Kurdish with her. And somebody else speaks Turkish with his father, but German with his mother, and so on and so on. So that was normal. And when you grow up like that, at adolescence, you try to forge your own identity, like every adolescent. Right. And this identity might be, we are the cool urban kids from a multi-ethnic area. Every one of us knows, can juggle languages. And that's how a totally new mixed language might evolve. But that doesn't happen under conditions of monolingual habitus. That doesn't happen in Germany or any European country. That happens, for instance, in Accra, in Ghana. Yeah, or in some other sub-Saharan African countries, you can see that. What you see in Northwestern Europe is a dialect of the extremely strong majority language emerges. Yeah, this majority language, in our case German, is so strong that for the kids, it's always the dominant language. This is what everyone, every single teacher in every single class speaks at school, what they hear on the TV, what they hear in the street. This German is so strong that what emerges here is just some dialect of German that is a bit more dynamic than the older dialects.
You've written about this idea of horizontal multilingual. So what does that refer to? Does that mean that Kiezdeutsch speaking community, different heritage languages are used sort of in conjunction with one another and not ranked in a hierarchy of prestige? Or does that mean Kiezdeutsch might even be something of a lingua franca, for example?
Well, German is always a lingua franca, be it in this kind of setting, yeah, be it in the form of Kiezdeutsch or standard German. It's not like these kids can't speak, can't understand each other otherwise. Horizontal multilingualism means that people are learning each other's additional home languages as well. So my kids learned some Turkish and some Arabic through kindergarten and through school. And a kid with Turkish grandparents might also learn some Arabic. So it's more horizontal than usually in a monolingual habitus country, repeating this term, but it's so central here, because usually you have it like, if I speak only German, I'm fine. Then I don't do anything else. Or in the States, if I speak English, that's it. I'm not expected to have to learn anything. But those people who those children or even adults who speak, say, Turkish or Arabic at home, they are expected to then learn German in Germany or English in the States. That is not horizontal. That's vertical multilingualism. But in Kiezdeutsch context, it's a bit more even out. German still has the strongest role there. It's the dominant language. But the other languages are not in such a strong hierarchy.
So one thing I also noticed that I didn't know before after reading some of your work is that many monolingual speakers rather speak Kiezdeutsch, or people that do not come from multilingual backgrounds. And so this seems to me that Kiezdeutsch has actually spread beyond multilingual neighborhoods from which they developed. And to, for example, you mentioned the Hellersdorf district, which you have written about. And so these are sort of speakers coming from monolingual German families. So how does a monolingual speaker who doesn't necessarily live in a space, a place with many Kiezdeutsch speakers, pick up Kiezdeutsch and start speaking it?
Well, yeah, I think it's good that you make the distinction between a speaker coming from a monolingual German home living in a multilingual neighborhood or in a more monolingually German neighborhood. Because First of all, monolingual speakers have been part and parcel of Keats Deutsch probably right from the start, although we don't have data from them, unfortunately, because monolingual German families make an important part of our multilingual inner city neighborhood. We're not so segregated. And that's how monolingually German speakers will acquire Keats Deutsch, will be just part of the Keats Deutsch speech community. But if you have people from, say, Hellersdorf, which is an Easter Berlin, more monolingually, monoethnically German neighborhood, they come in contact with Keats Deutsch through different media. Rap, for instance, often has a German rap, often has Keats Deutsch, or has been having that for a while. But also through movies, there was an extremely successful movie, Fuck You Goethe, a while ago. And it was one of the biggest cinema hits in Germany in, I don't know, forever or in decades at least. Where some of the protagonists spoke Keats Deutsch, and interestingly also one very blonde girl who so they were playing with these stereotypes and they were breaking through the cliches and showing more what the reality is. And I think not coincidentally the producer also comes from a multilingual family.
So then it seems to me that there is possibly a motivation for monolingual speakers to start using Keats Deutsch because, as you said, it's associated with this urban coolness. It seems to have a value for outside of the multilingual speakers. So maybe there's this prestige associated with it, actually, even if it's among just very young urban monolingual German speakers that don't live in multilingual neighborhoods. Do you think that's true?
Depends on the neighborhood. So there might be neighborhoods where people take some pride in not being multilingual. They might not just have a monolingual habitus, but also a monoethnic habitus all the way to racism. Then people wouldn't use that. But often, yeah, it's Keats Deutsch has what is often called a covered prestige. So no prestige in the majority society in terms of speak like that and you will considered an educated rich person.
Right.
And you will have success at the labor market or something. But prestige in exactly as you say, you will look cool among your friends.
So then what about the fact that Keats Deutsch is a youth specifically multi-ethnic? So these are young Germans, you know, in their teens, pretty far from being middle-aged people or even older. I know, for example, like switching between Keats Deutsch and standard German is something Keats Deutsch speakers need to do out of necessity when in formal settings, like in school, versus in informal settings, like talking on the street with friends and family. But are there more layers to this code switching? Are there more specific scenarios when, for example, a Keats Deutsch speaker might speak Keats Deutsch to an adult on the street or mix standard German with a heritage language that they speak? It seems like there's a whole spectrum of different ways to combine. I'm just wondering, what are these more specific scenarios?
Yes, and when we are speaking of this is standard German, this is Keats Deutsch, and this is, say, Turkish-German code switching, that's a very strong idealization. And in reality, it's not so clear-cut. You have to remember that an enormous amount of Keats Deutsch is identical with standard German. So it's not a totally strange language. It's just a dialect of what we have already. I think when speaking Keats Deutsch, that relates a lot to what you also talked about, this kind of street toughness image. So we have this within peer groups, but as far as we can see, female speakers speak it just like male speakers. But there is a certain image, a certain social persona that you might want to convey in certain situations and maybe not in others. We have kids who say, I would never speak like that to my parents. I respect them. So it's a bit like youth language everywhere. And the youth, so you have to distinguish between Kiezdeutsch grammar and Kiezdeutsch lexicon. So grammatically, Kiezdeutsch sure has a lot of features that are interestingly different from standard German, but fit into German grammar very well. And we can sometimes also find them in other areas. Lexically, there are a lot of youth language terms that come and go. Yeah, I hardly remember the terms from my youth language anymore. And the ones I do remember, nobody younger knows, never heard of those words. So, and these grammatical features, to as far as I can see, and we are lacking systematic data there so far, but just from living in the area and speaking with people, I feel that can be preserved in older age. So if I speak with my neighbor, who's not as old as I'm over 50, but she's like, I think in her 40s, she will often use some Kiezdeutsch grammatical constructions when talking to me, which she would never do when talking, say, our kids go to school together to a teacher there, because it doesn't give a good impression. And the teacher immediately thinks, okay, the kid can't speak German either. You know, then you have all these negative stereotypes popping up. But here we are just from friend to friend, from neighbor to neighbor, talking to each other, standing in the garden, then she might use that. So maybe Kiezdeutsch is becoming more of a dialect and yet less of a dialect that is only specific to a certain age group. Maybe it depends on when you're born, yeah, which generations you belong to, and not so much which age you actually currently have, whether this is still part of your repertoire.
That's interesting, because, and certainly Kiezdeutsch, it might transcend age, but it still, in some ways, is always about identity. And so that's what I want to actually ask you about next, is what does it actually mean in linguistics terms to express one's identity, quote unquote, through a language? When it's framed this way, it seems that Kiezdeutsch speakers, for example, might only choose to speak Kiezdeutsch or drop in a little Kiezdeutsch grammar because of some sort of external pressure that they have to establish their autonomy sort of through linguistic signaling. My question is, do Kiezdeutsch speakers deliberately switch into Kiezdeutsch or start using it because of an external pressure? Because there's a comparison to be made between Kiezdeutsch, for example, and the French Verlan, I think that's what it's called, where they invert the word orders. But it's not, of course, a dialect. It's just a way of inverting the rules. And so that implies a sort of rebelliousness. Is that true of Kiezdeutsch at all?
I think so. I don't know about pressure. I mean, let's say you're growing up in a neighborhood as a young person. In some way, there's always pressure to behave like the others. Yeah, you're growing up here. You have friends. You talk to them. Then, of course, you will talk a bit like them, or like the 5 year old older kids speak. I have the impression that this kind of youth language or urban dialect is more about not belonging. But if you're belonging to one group, of course, it always means you're not belonging to the other group. There is always this idea of border. It's always part of belonging. But I don't feel it's so terribly rebellious, especially because kids mostly speak that when nobody hears them, so when they are among themselves, which made it terribly difficult for us to get data. And I want to complain about this, because it was really a lot of work getting Kiezdeutsch data. We had to give them small recorders that they took with them, and they recorded themselves when talking with their friends in the afternoon after school. Mm. Interviews don't give you Kiezdeutsch data. So I don't see the rebellious bit so strongly. And you have to remember that we always convey some social persona and some identity when we speak. So you and I now speak a pretty standard close English. In my case, second language English, but pretty standard close. We didn't start with, hey, dude, how's hanging or something like that. Yeah.
Right.
So, so we also want to show some identity. We want to come across here as educated middle class. Yeah. And that also in some way, that's also saying we are not uneducated, whatever, underprivileged. We are privileged and we're educated. So all of us, when as soon as we open our mouth, we always try to convey some kind of social persona. And as I said, my husband is British. When I speak English with him, I will probably speak differently than with you now. So even as a second language user, I already make this difference. And even more so if I was a native speaker.
Wow, that's very interesting. I want to move on now to the consequences of Kiezsuich forming in an informal multilingual environment, specifically that there's this new dimension of rich linguistic possibilities in Kiezsuich. You've analogized Kiezsuich to a body of water. It's not a pool of features. The water is not still. It's a pond of features. It's to say it's not just a set of features coming from these context situations. It's a place where these features become interdependent on one another for a variety of purposes in speech. So it's an ecosystem where standard language varieties are often unchanging. Kiezsuich is, by this metaphor, much more dynamic. I don't want to get too technically specific about it, but I wonder, number one, what are these crucial syntactic, maybe phonological phenomena existent in Kiezsuich? And number two, what do these features say about standard German or other varieties of German? Are we learning more about standard German from Kiezsuich's features, its limitations, and its perhaps inefficiencies?
Yeah, I think so. So we have some phonological features, although they are not as strong as one might think. But one thing that's often been mentioned is that when you speak Kiezsuich, you often don't use the ich sound, but the ish instead. So ich means I in German, and you might pronounce it more like ish or nicht, nicht. We have that in other dialects of German as well, but it's become something like a stereotype of this Kiezsuich speaker that he or she does that. So that's something that we have in German already, just in some older regional dialects, for instance, in West Germany, in the Cologne area. An interesting syntactic phenomenon we found in Kiezsuich is some kind of word order. So in German, in a declarative sentence, you always have to have the verb in the second position. So you can say, I go to the cinema, or to the cinema go I, or tomorrow go I to the cinema. You can do whatever you want as long as go is the second thing that comes in that sentence. So that's the verb second rule. And in Kiezsuich, we found that you can have more than one element in front of that verb. So you can have verb third, so which makes it sound a little bit like English. So you can say, tomorrow I go to the cinema. And there are some grammatical restrictions on them, on this pattern. But altogether, it fits well into the syntactic layout of German. This is something when you read German grammars, a grammatical description of German, they will always say, isn't possible in German. It's a fixed rule. You have to have the verb in second place. No German speaker would do it differently. And then once we found that in Kiezsuich, we suddenly found it in myself, for instance, and not much, but I do that. We found it in professors giving talks at conferences, monolingually German grown up professors. It was just not so frequent. So then we compared our data from multilingual neighborhoods and monolingual neighborhoods, and we found the patterns are quite similar, but the frequency is higher in Kiezsuich. So KeenSearch kind of helps us put like a spotlight on ongoing variation. And when you look at the history of German, you find that this is something that used to be possible before present day modern High German was fully established. And maybe we're really gone. This option has kind of survived, but it hasn't survived in standard German. So in the German we use informal situations, or not to such a degree, but it might have survived in non-standard variety, in informal colloquial German.
Another feature that I've felt is notable to talk about is the simplification in KeenSearch, the inclination to refrain from declining words. It seems to me that this makes KeenSearch a really ripe target for criticism, because you know the language guardians, so-called, for say, for example, that this is an example of some greater cultural degradation because of a more precisely linguistic degradation. But because this feature is reduction, could you actually say that not declining or declining your words less is actually a natural result of KeenSearch having been formed in primarily informal circumstances? And how would you, I guess, as a public educator, how would you counter argue these views? Because I believe you could say that reducing inflections is actually, economizes the language more. It sheds a less necessary vestige of the language that has just been held on for centuries. But I see that there's possibly many ways to approach this.
Yeah, and I'm not against inflection.
Right.
But, well, don't get me started on these self-proclaimed language guardians. Let's just not talk about them. Well, the thing is that languages change. That's a trivial fact. And languages change all the time. And German has been moving from more inflection to less inflection for centuries. And we have this in modern German. There are a lot of inflectional endings lost that we used to have, say, only 100 years ago, and that now just sound old-fashioned. And even these self-proclaimed language guardians would not use these inflectional endings anymore. In addition, what happens in KeenSearch is always systematic. You're not just randomly leaving stuff out because you can't be bothered. Yeah, but what we have is we have some reductions that can be seen as continuation of what had been reduced already, and the reductions are actually not that terribly strong, so or frequent. Yeah, it's not like this is a language without inflection. It's, as I said, pretty close to spoken standard German, even closer to spoken vernacular German in other contexts. It just sometimes goes a step further.
On this note, I actually want to push a little further with the language guardians. In the KeenSearch corpus, otherwise known as KidCo, I believe. Is that the right way to say it?
Yeah.
Basically, it's a collection of KeenSearch speakers speaking in their, you know, their friend groups, KeenSearch writing, and it's all coalesces in one corpus. I'm specifically interested in KidCo E or KidCo Einstellungen, or in English, attitudes. So these are emails sent to you and you know, public writing on the subject. As you are the leading researcher in the world on KeenSearch, would that be true to say, pretty much?
Yeah, since KeenSearch, I don't know whether I'm the leading research. There are a lot of people who are working on that, but based on my research, I wrote a book, and it's now nearly 10 years ago, 2012, and that got a lot of media attention. So in that sense, that's was strongly associated. I got all these unsolicited emails.
Right.
People I don't know and don't really care so much about, who got super angry that, there was one Topos. So we collected these emails, and we also collected these readers' comments on newspapers' websites, what used to be a letter to the editor in the paper days. I had a look at them and analyzed them from a sociolinguistic point of view, and there were several topoi. That means two recurring themes or constructions of the topic. And one big deal was that I had suggested that we can account for keyed search best if we see it as another dialect of German. And it turned out that irked people, some people, a lot because of the way they pictured ownership of German. So who is a legitimate speaker of German? Who is legitimate speaker of a German dialect? Who's allowed to count themselves as a dialect speaker of German? And since these people constructed keyed search as something spoken by migrants, which isn't true. No, migrants don't usually speak keyed search. It's people, second generation Germans or monolingual Germans. They couldn't really fathom the idea that they might speak a German dialect. So it became pretty clear very fast that for some people, German dialects are the property of some imagined German ethnicity, and they do not want to include these kinds of speakers that they picture as part of this German in-group that they saw. So in the end, there was a lot of racism coming up. It was also, we also had a lot of positive reactions. So people saying, well, this kind of shows me I've been speaking some Pomeranian dialect, an old lady sent me, I'm 80 years old, I spoke Pomeranian dialect, and after Second World War, my family had to flee to the West, and I was always ridiculed. And now I finally feel vindicated. I'm finally proud of the way I speak at the age of over 80. So that really moved me a lot, these kinds of emails too, or people who said, well, I've been working with Turkish German adolescents and I always thought they don't speak properly, and now I'm interested in their language and we've had wonderful discussions and I'm on a much better footing with them now because now I'm interested in what they do and don't just see it evaluated negatively. So one has to see both sides, but like always, the trolls are always more numerous. Yeah, so people who just like your book don't necessarily send you lots of emails. Yeah, but people who really get het up, they will send you emails. So I got many, many more of those.
So then I'm wondering, amid a large stigma on Kiezdeutsch, is there a perhaps a counter movement from Kiezdeutsch speakers who are trying to get more representation of the dialect in mainstream media, maybe artists, singers, writers who are trying to depict Kiezdeutsch in a more positive way? Because I know, for example, in the United States, African American vernacular English, Black English, has been stigmatized through history of racism and more overt discrimination. But, you know, in such movements as the Harlem Renaissance, there are many writers who begin almost ethnographic work, and they're depicting the language and the lives of these speakers. They're giving them a voice to the mainstream yeah. world.
Kiezdeutsch is a bit different. It's maybe more like the English, say, of second generation US Americans whose parents came from Latin America. Mm-hmm. So, because Kiezdeutsch, you don't speak usually Kiezdeutsch, you don't grow up with Kiezdeutsch. Your parents won't speak Kiezdeutsch to you.
Right.
So people who speak Kiezdeutsch always have in their repertoire other kinds of other varieties of German as well, other registers, for instance. And this is very register dependent. So it's not such a broad dialect, but it is because of its cool image and because of its street prestige, it's used in art. I already mentioned rap. There are several German rappers who use it. We talked about the cinema movie, which was such a great success, and that's already a while ago. And I think there were three sequels now already. I don't know about literature, but that's because of me. So I'm sure there is literature where KeithSearch is used, at least in the form of people talking. Yeah, when you have direct speech in a novel, for instance. I don't know whether there are any books written altogether in KeithSearch. I doubt it, actually.
So I want to end here on what KeithSearch will be in the future. Is the multi-ethnic we're seeing right now, is it a tiny inchoate frame of KeithSearch in the span of a few decades? Is this going to explode in magnitude years from now? And will the status of KeithSearch mature in a sense, even as a multi-ethnic? Will it mature as speakers grow older? Will it no longer be necessarily a youth dialect that is commonly associated with multi-ethnics? And how will the perception of KeithSearch change as it's accepted into the linguistic repertoires of older folks, and it grows beyond the multilingual community and even monolingual community to places beyond perhaps urban areas?
Yeah, I think Germany has not such a strong urban-rural divide. So I think it's already there all over the place. So in small cities, as much as in big ones. And I think KeithSearch is here to stay. So this is a dialect that fits very well into German, that has a lot of grammatical features that that work well for German and that will establish further, I imagine. There is not such a strong divide between multilingual community and monolingual community. Normally, it's not that segregated. We had to look very hard to find a neighborhood for comparison, which is mostly monolingual. And today, that isn't even true for that neighborhood anymore. People mix them. It becomes more and more part of public awareness that we are a multilingual country and have always been. There's a demographic aspect to it. So when I'm being interviewed by journalists, for instance, these days I've noticed more and more often these journalists themselves have grown up with another heritage language. And this has become, so they are becoming more and more part of the ruling middle class and being visible, being new speakers, being inventors of a corona vaccine, for instance. That made a big difference. That was a company run by two Turkish Germans. Kids learn about KeithSearch at school as part of German class. So KeithSearch is in a lot of school books. You need to know about KeithSearch for your A-levels, for instance, in a lot of cases. So it's in the discussion. It's here to stay. I think it's establishing itself more and more.
So you mentioned the discussion of KeithSearch in schools. How else do you think, in your experience, do you think sort of public institutions can be better prepared or more aware of combating the prejudices that are created onto KeithSearch and multi-ethnics? And I ask this because in terms of Black English here in the States, what's been said by many linguists is that the general public isn't necessarily influenced just by the argument that Black English is systematic. Some might think that it's systematic, but systematically incorrect. So it's often been suggested that one of the better ways to, educate the public on a dialect like Black English is that you have to show how the dialect or the ethnolect is more complex than standard English. Would you say that's true about KeithSearch?
Yeah, I sometimes use that argument, but not just about KeithSearch, but about anything outside some imagined monolingual standard German. So there are several constructions in Kiezdeutsch that are more complex than the ones in standard German, and there are several constructions in other dialects or colloquial German that are more complex than in standard German, and vice versa, of course. I think that's a good argument, but I think the broader picture, the broader goal we should pursue is we need to get off this idea that there is one way to speak and that's the good way and everything else is wrong. So be it, there isn't just standard German, and even at school, we shouldn't just accept standard German by default as the only mode of communication possible in the classroom. There are more languages, there are more registers, more varieties, and we should use this richness. I mean, there are countries like Norway that don't have such a strong standard language ideology, and they are doing fine. In fact, in these PISA studies, they are doing better in a lot of respects than Germany. And this might be related to it, because children are not being discriminated on the basis of how they speak at home, and the language they speak at home is not being seen as something that doesn't count or isn't so good.
Finally, I just want to ask, where is your research going right now in terms of Kiezdeutsch? What are the questions you're asking? What are the topics specifically that you're searching the answers for? And maybe what are other researchers looking at in Kiezdeutsch?
We're still looking at the grammatical aspects, which are continue to be fascinating, like verb third. And this has now also become a topic in syntactic theory, where people are looking at this from a theoretical syntactic point of view. I'm always interested in sociolinguistic aspects, ideas of belonging, what becomes of Kiezdeutsch, and a new context. So right now we are looking at, we have a collection of WhatsApp messages by among friends and among strangers and by monolingual and multilingual speakers. And if young people use these messenger services in peer groups, you find a lot of Kiezdeutsch patterns, but you also find more. So right now, I'm very much interested in these aspects.
That also fascinates me a lot, the fact that you can use something as commonplace as text messages as linguistic data.
And great linguistic data, because it evolves, it develops so fast. It's really, I mean, if you want dynamics, that's the best place to go.
Well, I am really excited to see what things go with your research. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you
so much for taking your time to be on the podcast. You're a great inspiration to me. So please keep doing what you do.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much.